possessed, with undressed windows and faded to-let signs propped against their panes. In the back stood a railway cutting with the trains rattling noisily past, trailing clouds of smoke. He did not stop, but walked slowly on. A pale face appeared at the parlour window, then vanished, the drapes swaying back into stillness. He did not know if shade was inside or not, and he walked, with his face averted, until he was out of sight, and then doubled back and slid into a shadowed alcove facing the house. He smoothed his mustaches with his fingers. He checked his gun. He waited. 49. Flood heaved the crate up onto the bed of the wagon with a bang, and climbed unsteadily aboard after it, and shoved it farther up against the rear slats. Fool crouched, got up into the driver's bench. Neither man spoke, but both tipped their caps to any lady who passed, and Flood whistled pleasantly while unhooking the mare's nosebag, and then he hauled himself up behind the reins. They rode slowly and kept to the thoroughfares, and were soon lost in the chaos, and they made their way south towards the Strand, and then they were crossing the Thames under a lowering sky, while the river traffic slid by underneath. There were plumes of brown smoke ahead in the haze of Southwark, where the factories churned night and day, and they drove east until they reached the Booth Brothers factory gates, and there they slowed and came to a halt some 20 paces past. Appleby Barr kept a small shabby office in the rear of the second floor, and Fool intended to offer him the entire hall to settle his debts and establish credit, and he would take only a small fee in exchange. The £10,000 from the paintings negotiation would take care of their needs for some time. As he turned to get down, Flood put a hand on his arm. It felt heavy, hot.
"We ought to be careful, Mr. Edam. The bugger's like to be watched hisself."
Fool nodded. "He has 2 peelers who stand at the gates taking the measure of anyone who goes inside."
"On his payroll?"
"I'm sure. But with peelers, who can say?"
"You can't know his intentions neither."
Fool paused, studied Flood's face.
"Barr has nothing to gain by complicating his relationship with me," Fool said softly. "I'm not anxious in that regard. Wait here."
He got down and crossed the street, examining the faces of the indigent there, until he found a particular creature folded upon its haunches, crouched against the lee of an inner court, in rags twice its size.
"Geoffrey," he murmured. The waif cast a mistrustful eye.
Fool withdrew a guinea from his waistcoat pocket and shuffled over, and held it out in a trembling palm.
"Go on," he said. "Take it."
"Why, Mr. Fool, sir,"
the waif whispered in astonishment, and snatched it quickly up.
"I've been here all morning like you said to, sir. I've seen him going."
"Was he alone?"
"Never had no grippers with him, if that's your meaning."
Fool crouched, ancient with pain.
"It don't hardly look like you at all, Mr. Fool,"
the boy said in wonder,
"if I can say so."
"There's another guinea for you if you do one last thing," Fool said.
"Aye, sir."
"Those 2 peelers, just inside, that you told me about, I want you to call them away down the street in 5 minutes. Tell them there's been a carriage overturned. Tell them it looks like a lady is injured. Can you do that for me?" Eyes like slits. A tooth out in front.
5 minutes.
Fool gestured to the public clock face on the market building opposite.
"You can count the time, Geoffrey?"
A sudden quick grin through the filth.
"Aye, for a guinea I can, sir."
Back at the wagon, Fool stood with one hand on the footboard and the other on his hip. Flood was studying the open iron gates of the factory, the yard beyond where barrels swung suspended in nets, and stacks of tall crates were just visible. A man in shirt sleeves and a leather apron came to the street, and stared west, and removed his cap and ran a hand through his hair, and then went back inside. Fool knew that yard well, the solid iron doors to the factory beyond, the orphans creeping barefoot among the machinery, and sweeping out the corners, and the suspended catwalks, with the overseers stalking back and forth. Bard had taken the place from the 3 Booth brothers 4 years earlier, in exchange for a debt, and established a front for his activities, and he arrived at his office 3 days a week promptly, and sat at his desk, going through his ledgers, and taking meetings like any good industrialist.
There would be men with knives and clubs and others with pistols at the doors and the base of the stairs.
10 minutes, said Fool. Then go on inside.
You ain't coming.
He shook his head. I'll meet you in Newington. Give me an hour.
You got somewhere more important to be?
Something like that.
The giant leaned, creaking down.
Go on,
he muttered, incredulous.
You ain't serious, like.
There's someone I need to say goodbye to, Fool said. An old friend I don't expect to see again.
He met his companion's eye. Mr. Barr's expecting us, Japheth. I've known the man years. He's in the red.
He don't worry me.
Fool went around back and climbed into the bed of the wagon and opened the crate and sifted through the contents.
You did fine, he said. There's plenty here.
He withdrew, at last, a long, ornate, seven-branched candlestick made of silver, ran his fingers over the weird symbols at its base, the vine scrollwork in delicate detail, flowering the length of the stalks, glanced around, then slid it under the wing of his coat, and buttoned himself back up and jumped down.
A price on the lot of it, then? Flood said dubiously. You want I should drive the bargain?
Fence it for what you can, Fool said. But don't drive it. Whatever we lose in the turnover, we gain in good grace. There's no losing here.
And he reached up and took the man's hand and then went off in search of a cab. Some 20 feet away, he paused and turned back, a strange feeling in him. Flood was seated in the wagon, shaggy head upraised, fixed and unmoving, like a warning from a world that was no longer about a world that was to come. 50. William had not waited 30 minutes when an old man in a scuffed black suit walked up Penton Place and stepped lightly across a puddle and made his way down towards the terrace house. William knew him at once, even in disguise. He waited, but he saw no curtain stir, no light go on. No one else came or went. He had seen no sign of the manservant, Flood. That man had lived a life of brutality and violence, but Shade was the more dangerous by half. After a moment, William detached himself from the shadow and crossed the street cautiously, and went up the steps and banged on the front door with an open hand.
Shade! He shouted. Shade!
He kicked at the frame with his boot. When there was no sound from within, he stepped back and glared up at the facade. The house stood dark and closed. He stood calmly in the front walk and held his Colt out before him, and methodically dialed through its loaded chambers, knowing they would be watching him, and knowing Shade would see the seriousness in him. Then he turned and lazily lifted one elbow, and punched in the glass of the sidelight, and reached in and unlocked the door. He paused then, listening, glanced back at the street. At last, his fists bared, he stepped inside. In the gloom, he stood letting his eyes adjust, listening as the grandfather clock clicked down through its registers, and the timbers of the house creaked around him. Shards of glass crunched under his feet like frost. The parlor door stood open. He could make out a mahogany table, stained the color of blood, an empty birdcage, stairs rising into shadow.
"Edward!" he called up. "I've come to talk!"
Stillness and gloom. He held his Colt low at his side.
"Show yourself!"
he shouted. There was the bang of a door closing, and William started to move. But something slid flashing past the corner of his eye, and he turned and saw the child emerging from the darkness, and the child's low, quick hand, and then he saw the fireplace poker. He moved before he could stop himself, and had the girl by the throat, and his hand reached in a crushing grip from ear to ear, and he knocked the poker aside and threw the girl backward. She lay crumpled against the wall amid a shatter of debris, and her limbs did not look right, but her chest was moving. He glanced down at a line of blood welling up from his hand and closed his fist upon it, and then he heard a low grunt from the front steps outside and turned. It was the manservant, Flood. He came roaring in out of the grey noon light, elemental with rage, and a long knife upraised in one fist, and William took an unsteady step back, but could not find his footing on the broken glass, and he lifted his gun, and he fired. 51. Fool heard the crack and shatter of glass in the foyer below, and for an impossible moment thought he had imagined it. He was alone in the house but for Molly. He had just peeled the disguise from his face and was wiping with a moist towel at the strings of glue on his skin when Pinkerton had started shouting for shade in the street below. Fool knew no lawful charges had been laid, and that meant the detective was acting outside the law, and not bounded by its rules, and the knowledge of it made him, for the first time, afraid. He went at once to the open suitcase and took out his old revolver. It was scarred and notched, but he had kept it in good working order since the days of his suffering in Virginia. He checked its chamber, clicked it shut, slipped it into the waistband of his trousers. He picked up the leather satchel with the gallerist's bonds inside, then he ran for the servants' stairs. On the first floor landing he felt something give in his knee, and he sucked in his breath, but did not slow, nor did he make a sound. He paused, breathing silently, and stared in the gloom, but heard nothing, and then he saw Molly materialize at the door of the kitchen.
"Adam," she hissed, "go, now."
She turned from him, ducked away. He paused, one hand on the balustrade, the other fumbling his old revolver, the satchel tucked under his elbow. He found her again lurking wraith-like at the door to the hall, listening intensely towards the front of the house.
"Edward!" a voice bellowed. "I've come to talk."
"We need to go, Molly," he said softly. He could not make out her eyes.
"Show yourself," Pinkerton was hollering.
"He ain't interested in no one except you," she whispered. "Go on. I'll slow him down some, and then make myself scarce."
Fool shook his head, but he understood the truth in it, and that the child had the steady, swift hand of a creature of the streets, and that she had never been a stranger to violence. He put a hand on her arm.
"You know where I'll be."
She nodded angrily at the dark scullery beyond.
"Bloody go," she said.
When he turned back, he caught a glimpse of Molly, pale and ethereal in the gloom, flowing through the kitchen towards the front of the house with a barbed iron poker in one fist, and then he heard the detective huffing and stamping in the hall like a bull, and he was opening the scullery door and stumbling out into the cold. When the gunshot sounded, he slowed at the high edge of the railway cutting, and he started to go back, but then he stopped. The pain in his knee was savage. He did not hear a second shot. He was standing with his coat open, unsure what to do, and the fog moving around him, and he fumbled with the satchel and took out the revolver and checked its chambers, and stared back through the haze, and thought he glimpsed, for just a moment, a silhouette staggering out of the scullery door into the garden, lifting its face, peering up at him. And then the fog closed in, and the figure, whatever it was, dissolved again away. 52. William could not find his footing, and he lifted his gun and fired, but the bullet passed harmlessly to one side. Then the giant's huge arm came down. It came down swatting the Colt from William's hand as if striking down a wasp. Both gun and knife cracked against the floor, skittered off into the darkness. His forearm and elbow were ringing like steel hammered flat, and he swung around and tried to avoid the giant's grip, but he could not do so. The man took him in both arms as if he were beloved. He lifted him from the earth. He could feel the great, slow power of the giant's embrace, and his vertebrae popped one by one, and he could not breathe. A blackness was creeping in at the edges of his vision, and he crushed his eyes shut and opened them, a ringing in his ears. He could smell the vinegar stink of the giant's sweat, and the man's coarse beard scraped against his nose in some demented kind of nuzzle, and he could feel the man's breath hot in his eyes. He thought of Margaret and of his daughters in their spring garden in Chicago among the cherry blossoms, and he bared his teeth, and he bit with all his strength into the giant's face, and the blood was hot, and he came away with a piece of the man's cheek in his mouth. The man shuddered but did not let go. William drove his forehead mightily down upon the giant's face and felt the man's nose split like ripe fruit, both of their faces streaming with blood, and then he was free. He slithered to the floor, gasping. The giant was on his knees also, cradling his face and shaking his head from side to side. William got unsteadily to his feet, swayed, picked up the iron poker where the girl had dropped it, and dragged it, scraping over the floorboards, and lifted his hand and swung. He stayed only long enough to watch the giant fall. When he stumbled out the back door and into the garden, he saw the figures silhouetted in the fog at the top of the railway embankment, and he knew it would be Shade. Then the fog closed in, and he stumbled into a run. At the back of the garden he found a gate, a series of in-cut steps beyond. He went up, gasping, and wiping with his sleeve at the blood drenching his mustaches and his chin, his face dripping like some ghoul just risen, his right arm dangling useless at his side. At the top of the stairs he found himself on a high stone wall, and he could see into the cutting below. He glanced swiftly along the railway ties where they stretched sleekly out of the earth towards the city itself, like an incision, but could see no sign of Shade. The stones were slick underfoot, and covered here and there in patches of tall grey weeds bending up through the cracks, and William stumbled on at that eerie height, with the backs of the terrace houses in the fog beyond half concealed, and the strangeness of that space, as if he were moving through the backstage of some theatrical production. Then he saw Shade. The thief was not running. He stood favoring one leg and faced William as he approached, and the revolver in his hand looked light, warm, as if it were a part of him, some smooth extension of his wrist, and not iron, but flesh. He raised this part of himself and held it out in a kind of offering of violence, and William went very still. "Are you alone?" Shade called. William said nothing. He was standing some 10 paces away, and knew he could not bridge that distance. "Go back to Chicago," Shade called. "This is finished."
"The hell it is."
"William." He took a step forward, bloody palms raised.
"Tell me about my father," he shouted. "What happened between you?"
The cold fog drifted around them, pressing in and pulling apart like a thing alive. Slowly Shade turned his face aside and peered down into the shadows of the cutting below as if listening for a train, and after a moment William could feel it also, the low thrumming in the stone underfoot, as if the earth itself was set trembling, the distant roar, the far whoosh and insuck of air.
"Edward," he called.
He ran a bloodied wrist over his forehead.
"Whose blood is that?"
That weapon still leveled at his heart. The train grew louder. William stared down at his wrist, as if only just seeing it, and then he looked up in surprise.
"I didn't kill them," he shouted. "Flood or the girl. Neither of them."
Shade said something, but the roar of the train drowned out his words, and then he shook his head and shouted angrily,
"This isn't how your father would have wanted it."
"I'm not doing this for him."
Shade hollered,
"Your whole life has been for him."
And then the train roared up out of the earth, black and aflame in a whirlwind of smoke and fury, and Shade gave him a strange, regretful look and limped to the edge of the cutting. The smoke boiling up around him, the air crackling his clothing into silhouette and curling up around the satchel and its 10,000 pounds and knocking his hat from his head.
"Witch!"
William cried. The thief glanced back once, but William could not see his face, and then he turned and stepped casually out into the maelstrom and vanished. There was neither blood nor carnage, no long drag of a body, no stain or smear on the tracks, only the man's hat caught in a tangle of weeds where it had been sucked over. William climbed down and retrieved it and stood with it in his hands, staring at the suddenly vacant cutting around him. He could feel the cold crumpling of his shirt where the blood had dried. After a short while, he climbed back out and saw the swing of a bullseye lantern in the fog, its beam startling and sliding over the slick stones and crossing and sliding again away. That was a young helmeted constable called in by neighbors who had heard gunshots. A runner was sent. John Shaw descended. The vacant terrace house was gone over, but no trace of Shade's destination was found.
"So he's gone,"
Shaw said, standing at the precipice of the embankment, banging his hat against his thigh.
"Edward Shade's gone."
William closed his eyes, opened his eyes, and then he was missing Margaret with a passion that left him gutted and trembling.
"I guess so," he said. "I guess he is."
In the end, everyone would come to grief, he knew. No one would be spared. There were the dead in his own country, too. The following morning, he went out to the steamship offices on the Lower Strand and purchased a one-way ticket to New York, set to depart in 10 days' time, and when he stepped back out into the street, he was struck all at once by the stark, desolate beauty of the city. The clerk who had sold him his ticket had upgraded him from second class at a reduced rate, and William had set his gloved fist on the counter and studied the young man, and then nodded and thanked him. Over the Thames, the winter sky was very blue, very cold. He rubbed his hands, walked briskly, sat an hour in a cafe at a table near the steamed over windows, studying a railway timetable, planning a route north. He had 10 days before sailing and thought he might go to Glasgow. He wanted away from London. At noon he went into a haberdasher's off Piccadilly and purchased several elaborate hats in the French style for his wife and daughters. They had enormous soft brims and slouching ostrich feathers, and he filled out his address in Chicago and instructed the sales clerk to pack them with care. For his brother he purchased a leather-bound set of Dickens. He wrote to Margaret. He wrote to Robert. He sent several telegrams with details of his arrival in New York. He returned to his hotel and slept a dreamless sleep, and woke in the evening, refreshed. His old steamer trunk he packed slowly, as if to fill his hours, and his folded shirts he tied with twine, and the package, with Edward Shade's measurements and fingerprints, he laid between the clothes. He locked the trunk and left the key standing in it, pointing at him like a finger. No, he did not believe the thief dead. That night he shaved using hot water from his bath, and he dried his face with a clean towel. He wiped his hand across the mirror and stared at his worn face, unsatisfied. The next morning was Sunday, and it brought a knock at the door. He opened it in his shirt sleeves and saw John Shaw, bareheaded, picking at his hat, and the chief glanced up and said, "There's something you should know. Shouldn't you be at church?" Shaw smiled tiredly. He handed across a small slip of paper with an address scrawled upon it in brown ink. William glanced at it.
"What's this?"
"It's in the southwest, out past Sands End. I had Mr. Blackwell make some inquiries." William stood perplexed, and neither man spoke for a long moment, and then Shaw said gruffly,
"It seems she isn't dead after all."
And he gripped William's shoulder, and there was kindness in it, and even a little pity, and then he set his hat back on his head and went. He did not go to Scotland. That afternoon he took passage on a crowded passenger steamer at Waterloo Pier, and journeyed upriver through the noise, and he disembarked at Pimlico Pier watching the sky for rain. There he hired an ancient rowboat oared by an old man with a single yellow tooth standing up from his lower gums. The man's accent was thick, and William could not understand him. They rowed slowly on west, passing under the dripping arches of Battersea Bridge, and wending uneasily in the shallows past the low-set colliers moored at the mouth of Chelsea Basin, where the gasworks lay. The sky darkened. A stretch of meagre brown meadow came into view on the north bank, and the old man in his oilskin rowed in silence, his eyes on William's face. The river traffic thinned. At last they reached Broomhouse Dock, and William got out, his legs stiff, and he set off walking up the lane past the estates there, until he reached Fulham Road. The air was crisp, clean, trees and fenced-in fields lining the roads. He turned north again towards Walham Green, and it started to rain, and he drew his hat low, but did not seek shelter. The rain was not heavy. He had to stop and ask directions, as he could see no street signs, but at last he found the low stone walls of Westminster Cemetery, and her small cottage set within sight of the fields of the dead. He scraped his shoes on the iron scraper, stamped them twice for good measure. Then he knocked and waited what seemed a long time while the rain dripped from the eaves. A bolt rasped in its drawer. The door opened. Standing there was an old woman, leaning stoutly in her rags like a melted candle. One gnarled hand trembled on the edge of the door. William was shaking his head and staring, and she was squinting back from the fog of her failing eyesight like a woman confronting a ghost.
"You don't got no sense at all, do you?" she said at last, and waved a gruff hand, her voice dry.
She kept clearing her throat and flaring her nostrils, as if struggling for breath, some low flicker of something in her cloudy eyes.
"Sally Porter,"
he said, holding his hat in his hands, water streaming down his face.
"Sally Porter."
The cottage was small but warm, for a wood fire burned in the grate. On the mantel, fastened in its own wax, and leaning at a crazy angle, stood the stub of a red candle. William sat in his wet clothes on a dirty sofa. There was no carpet over the bare planks, and the boards were coming loose in their nails, and creaked under his weight. It was a square room, and he saw at a glance the stained wallpaper some 20 years out of fashion, and under it, in places, the crumbling plaster. She shuffled slowly at her tasks, and her hands shook, and she kept her eyes downcast. He did not take off his coat. On the table in the corner stood an elegant 7-branched silver candlestick with a vine carved into its stalks. He did not need to look closer to know its origin.
"I ain't gonna ask how you found me," she said.
He shrugged. "John Shore."
"Ha! That John Shore never tracked nothing in his life."
But now that he had come, he felt an overwhelming sadness and suddenly wished he had not found her. He gestured half-heartedly with his hat and said,
"It's nicer than the last. I like the candlestick. As a judge."
She grunted.
"We put some money aside."
"I got your letter."
"I know you did."
"What happened to California?" Sally gave him a quick, sharp look. She sat in a high-backed rocking chair, and a white cat unfurled from under the window and padded over to her and leaped into her lap. She combed her knuckles through the cat's fur. It all felt suddenly mean and heavy to William, the shock of seeing her beginning to dissipate. He said, directly,
"Edward Shade is gone."
She inclined her head, yes. Her face was hard. There was no apology in it.
"I came here to ask for the truth, Sally."
"I know you did."
His lips were dry, his tongue thick as cotton webbing in his mouth. He was thinking about her letter, and Edward Shade, and struggling to put it together. But something was not right, and he could not do so.
"Will you tell me about it?" he said gently. "Will you tell me how it happened?"
"You ain't likely to understand it," she said.
But she paused, and some uncertainty twisted in her face, and then she said,
"He always was a good boy, or near enough to one, Billy, like you was, and he grown up to be a fine man despite it all."
"You can't mean Shade."
"All right.
You've been in contact with him all this time?"
"Not like you mean it."
He shook his head. "Shade betrayed my father," he said softly. "He lied to him, humiliated him. My father trusted you."
"Stop all that now. Ain't no understanding a cat by skinning it."
He watched the old woman's cat lift its face and stare into the corner, then rise like smoke and vanish into the gloom. He got to his feet, crossed to the dirty window. He felt huge and dark, a wrath rising.
"What would Ben have said?"
he muttered. Sally looked away, her gnarled hands locked and rigid in her lap, like twists of driftwood. Then William understood.
"Ben was a part of it too. You and Ben both. Lying to my father all these years.
Don't you talk like that.
And to me, you must have been terrified. You must have thought I was there to—"
"No."
"And all that in the letter, the things you sent me. He gave those to you. Shade did."
"Billy,
I was such a fool,"
he said bitterly. "You ain't going to understand it. Your father, he loved that poor boy like he were a son to him. like it were you or Robert, either one. I reckon it were his worst grief. I ain't saying it to hurt you.
The hell he did.
She gave him a long, slow, measured look, and it seemed to William he was being seen through, stared into, as if she had lost one kind of vision for some other, a way of seeing that would cut her off from this world of the human and the hidden. She said,
"My Mr. Porter found him 6 years ago now. He were working deliveries, and followed some dipper not hardly more than a child up out of Bermondsey, and she led him right down to a park. And who do you reckon was standing there but Edward hisself? Edward didn't hardly hesitate, just walked right up to Ben, and put his arms round him, and give him a hug like to take the life out of him. He knew he was being hunted. I reckon he known it for always. Your father, bless his heart, he was wanting for something, some notion of rightness. I reckon you know that better than most."
Something turned over in William's stomach, some foreboding. "After the war ended, Edward went up to Chicago to find him," Sally said. She was peering in his direction with her vague eyes, and when he said nothing, she said,
"Your father, he done just returned from the Miro gang murder out of Texas. Young Edward broke into your father's study with a knife and a pistol."
He did not interrupt, but still she raised a hand as if to stay his questions.
"Edward waited for your father with the express purpose of shooting him dead," she said,
nodding and nodding as she spoke.
"That boy was all of 18 years old, and he carried nothing but murder in his heart. He sat behind your father's desk, and he listened to you folks talk out in the hallway. He known what had been done, see? He'd had 4 years to think it through, and he come to the conclusion that your father sent Ignatius Spar into Richmond to tie up his loose ends. He supposed your father and General McClellan come under scrutiny, and no further embarrassment after Lewis and Scully and poor Timothy Webster was to be risked. He were just cleaning house, is how he put it."
Sally worked her lips, as if rubbing some oil into them, and then she lifted her face.
"The one thing young Edward weren't never able to understand was just how the Confederate Secret Service got to him so quick. They was there outside his door almost before Spar come at him. He fought off Spar and killed him in the fight, and they was in the room quick as sugar on a finger."
She took a long, slow, rattling breath, and then she sat a moment in the gathering gloom as if she had lost the thread, and then she nodded in his direction.
"Spar done turned," she said. "An assassination is what it was. But who had ordered it?"
"Not my father, or not only him," Sally said quietly.
"Truth was, Spar was taken by the Confederates his second day in Richmond and made a deal for his life. Oh, he had Confederate fingers in his pocket, no mistake. And if he'd succeeded, if he'd killed Edward, then the Confederates would have taken him into custody just the same, and hanged him just the same, like they'd done to Webster."
"Why would they do that?"
She shrugged.
"Everyone was betraying everybody. Except my father. Except your father. And Edward."
A log collapsed in the hearth. William scoffed.
"How do you know all this?"
But she didn't answer. Instead, she said,
"Young Edward didn't know none of this either when he gone to your father's study that night. He meant to kill your father dead, and when your father come in and seen Edward, he knowed it also. He told me once, he said, the boy's eyes wasn't even human that night. It frightened him, it did. They didn't light no candles but the one. They sat in the near darkness, the house going about its ordinary nighttime business, the maid going up and down them stairs. But now Edward didn't shoot. There was something in your father's face that gave him pause. What do you suppose that was?"
William sat quiet, listening. The rain had stopped.
"Your father, he was crying. That were what stayed Edward's hand. He made no sound, but he were crying. And Edward tried to hold on to his spite, and he told him what he'd come to do and what he held your father accountable for.
Your father just looked at young Edward and said that was okay, except he didn't want your mother to find his body. Then he said he'd searched for Edward after the war, and did the boy know about it? He said he'd resigned from the service in 62, in part because the government had refused to negotiate Edward's release. He said every man had something he has to do in his life to learn what he is capable of, and to understand the past can't be altered none, nor corrected. And he said if killing him could not be avoided, then it were best it were done quickly, and Edward got himself gone. And then he did one thing that left the boy more confused than ever. He stood up, and he come round the desk, and he pulled him towards him, and he hailed him. Shade never shot at him. Edward said he always figured your father wanted him to. They sat like that a long moment. "Why didn't you tell me about this before?" he asked. "Why did you lie to me?" "Some truths ain't ours to do with as we'd wish, Billy. You gotta let some things go if you're going to find happiness. Your father, he ain't never understood this."
"My father."
"Now you listen," she said sharply. "I loved your father, and my Mr. Porter did too. Weren't nothing we wouldn't have done for him. That's God's own truth."
He looked at her without anger, but she flinched all the same. He pulled his wet hat low and went to the door and started to go, but then he paused.
"Where is he?" he said. "Where did he go?"
"I ain't never known that," she said gruffly.
"Where is he, Sally?"
She wet her cracked lips, glared across at him.
"Don't you leave here pretending like I ain't got no notion of how things was. Your father could be right mean and difficult and about as forgiving as a hole in a boat. I known how it was between you. I ain't the one trying to forget it."
Her voice was creaking, and she fell silent then, as if out of breath. A shadow, like a great wing, passed over the far wall.
"Where is he?"
he said a third time.
"Ah, now, Billy,"
she said, her face twisted into a mask of grief.
"He's gone on ahead to Argentina. He's gone. You best to let it lie."
"Argentina," he said.
He looked at her as if for the last time.
"Is there more?"
She peered up at him through milky eyes.
"Not that I can tell to you."
He opened the door of the cottage, his back to her.
"You should thank God my father's dead," he said. "He'd have broke his damn heart."
There was only one liner leaving direct for Buenos Aires, and it did not depart Liverpool until that Saturday. All week, William slept late and ate heavily and settled his affairs at Scotland Yard and said nothing of Sally's information to Shaw or Blackwell. His anger again cooled. He turned over Sally's account in his mind, trying to make sense of it, but he could not do so. On Friday evening he took an overnight train to Liverpool and, in the morning, walked out of the railway station and down to the riverfront pier, with a red sun low in the sky at his back. He descended a rattling wood quay, walked through a crowd of strangers, weeping into their hands, his own gloved fists curled like great brown spiders. The pain in his ribs was at last beginning to subside. The dark liner loomed at its moorings, and he walked its length. On board was a coffin holding a young actress bound for New York, but this meant nothing to him. He waded through the curious and the grieving, a head taller than most, and his tall silk hat taller yet. He wore black, like a figure out of nightmare, and his eyes were cold, and his moustaches thick, and no man who met his eye held it for long. He spoke to no one. He carried no luggage. He trudged up the gangway with his thick shoulders turned, and he went through and in. It was the last day of February 1885. He was thinking about the minutiae of life, what a person was and was not. He was not given by nature to philosophical problems, and felt largely that the thing in front of him was mostly what it looked like and felt like, though this, too, he knew, was a kind of philosophy. He had wept for his father after the funeral, but it had been a strange, furtive kind of grief, and what he felt now, pressing past the figures with their waving handkerchiefs and their clutter of luggage, was not the same, but something very close. He made his way below decks in the first-class area to the second largest of the staterooms, and fumbled in his pockets, but they were empty, and when he tried the door he found it unlocked. There were several trunks and suitcases on the floor beside the bedding alcove. They had not yet been stowed for the passage, and he glanced at them and then glanced away. He could hear ladies laughing in the hallway beyond, and he shut the door with a clang and walked to the small sofa under the porthole. He sat. He stood. He paced. On the narrow desk was a morning edition looking unread, and William picked it up and studied the headlines. It was 7 days old, and the front page was covered with articles about the stolen painting's return, and notions about the men responsible and the motives behind it. William had heard rumors that Farquhar had engineered the entire thing for the publicity. One politician had suggested the Russians were responsible. The world of men was, he thought, ridiculous. Then there was a low scraping at the door, and then the handle punched down, and Edward Shade stepped through. He saw William at once, but only nodded and took off his hat and smoothed down his white hair. If he was astonished to see the detective, he gave no sign. He smiled a wry smile and crossed to the cupboard of the stateroom, and returned with a bottle of port and two glasses hung upside down from between his knuckles. "I was hoping you would show," he said, appending the glasses with a clink on the desk and unstoppering the bottle. William smiled cautiously. "We never said a proper farewell. Isn't it strange how some things come full circle?" There were gulls crying in the morning sky outside, and William watched Shade pass across a glass, then sit with his legs crossed at the knee. "You're alone?" Shade said. William inclined his head. Shade shrugged, but there was a weariness to it. "My excellence, Mr. Flood, is here with me somewhere, as you will have gathered, a little bored and looking for excitement."
"His face?"
"Well, his career on the stage will be ruined." William furrowed his brow.
"And the girl?"
"Molly.
She's all right.
She doesn't take a knock without wanting to give one back." William nodded. "I didn't come here to do violence," he said. "I should be disappointed if you had." The thief was wearing a fine striped suit cut for warmer weather. He sipped his port, and William watched the morning light flare and fracture in the cut glass, but he himself did not drink, and he held the delicate glass between his thick fingers, feeling rough and tired. His eyes were sore. Shade waited. At last William shifted in his seat and let his frock coat fall open to reveal the Colt at his side, and he ran his tongue along his gums and grimaced, and said,
"I brought you something."
Shade furrowed his brow. He was holding his walking stick loose across his knees as if to ward off some sudden movement. William fumbled in his frock coat and withdrew the folded photograph from Sally Porter. He opened it and studied the muddy camp at Cumberland, the operatives in their cool horror, his younger father chewing on his cigar, his hard Scottish eyes black as obsidian. The blur of the bad capture of the boy Shade had been. He passed it across and Shade took it and stared at it, and then he murmured,
"That was another lifetime."
"It wasn't."
Shade looked up, his eyes glinting in the shadow.
"I loved your father," he said quietly, "but I was never his son."
"That's right. You weren't."
Shade sighed. He set the photograph on the side table.
"You've been to see Sally, then?"
"I've seen her. Yes."
Shade regarded him carefully, sipped his drink, said nothing. William cleared his throat.
"Here's what I don't understand," he said. "Here's what I haven't stopped puzzling over, not since I talked to her. My father hired the porters to find you. Why would he send operatives you had known and would recognize? Why send two Negroes into London, for God's sake?"
"He trusted them."
"He didn't trust anyone. But he loved them, and I believe they loved him. Yet when they found you, they didn't report you, and even began to work for you. They were my father's oldest associates. He had helped smuggle them to freedom, They had stood by him during the war, but still they ended up working for you.
Shade said nothing, his luminous eyes brilliant. A wry smile, soft as velvet, soft as a handshake in the dark.
They protected your secret, William pressed.
What can I confess to? I'm a charming man.
Not that charming.
Shade shrugged.
I paid them well.
They never cared about money.
Everyone cares about money.
William shook his head, but ignored this, and he said instead,
My father left no file, no reports, nothing that could be traced back to you.
Because the porters destroyed them.
He never risked his only copy of anything. He kept reports of his childhood medical exams, for God's sake. He kept dental records on his horses.
Shade studied him.
What are you saying, William?
William leaned forward and set his glass of port, untouched, on the low steel table. The liquid wobbled into equilibrium.
I'm saying you've been played, he said.
A fold of darkness between Shade's eyes, a crease of a frown.
All this time you thought you had him deceived.
Because I did,
Shade said with a low ferocity.
He never caught up to me. He knew you were alive.
Yes.
And exactly where to find you.
Shade smiled a quick, incredulous smile.
All these years you've been hiding from him. All this time. And you never realized it. He didn't hire Sally and Ben to find you. He hired them to watch out for you.
That's ridiculous.
You and your famous luck, William went on, escaping the police in Montreal just before the Pinkertons arrived, avoiding prison in Boston and New York, somehow getting out of the trains before they were searched, crossing the Atlantic how many times without being recognized. You never wondered about it? You never thought it unlikely?
William rose wearily. He put on his hat and ran a finger along the brim. He pulled on his gloves. The ship's horn sounded three times, like a warning out of a dream. The daylight darkened imperceptibly. He had crossed to the door of the stateroom, and he paused now, with his hand on the door, and his great bulk looming. He looked back at the thief, and was surprised to feel a kind of sadness. He looked at the smaller man's beautiful eyes, and wondered at the love his father must have held for the man. The clean, manicured hands, the fold of his pinstriped trousers, a crescent of morning light crossed his cheekbones and whiskers.
I didn't come to say goodbye, he said with a frown. I came because I wanted you to know.
Shade stared at him. The glass of port was very still in his hand.
Know what? He said.
Outside the cold waters ran red in the red light. There were gulls crying and wheeling in the sky, and their shadows rippled and cut across the surface of the river. William smiled a sly smile.
That I can find you, he said.
Epilogue. 1913. Oregon. When does a life begin its decline? His wife had been dead now nearly 18 years. He thought of that sometimes with a faded sorrow. His younger daughter had nearly died in an automobile accident in 1905, and the elder had married and moved away. He still wrote both long letters even now, though his handwriting had deteriorated to a scrawl, and he sometimes burned with a longing to see them again, which he felt like a physical pain. It would overwhelm him and leave him gasping. When his brother died in August of 1907, he knew at last he was truly alone. He slept less and less, and then he slept too much. His hair grayed, and he cut off his mustaches, and he changed the cut of his suits to weather the times. His office in Chicago was dark with leather and mahogany, and paintings of long-dead thoroughbreds, and it began to feel like a room preserved. As the years passed, there were fewer and fewer dossiers on his desk each night, and slowly he began to slip from the office earlier and earlier in the day. He became a man revered. At banquets, he sat in the place of honor. When he rode down to the stables of an evening, he still wore his Colt Navy, but the chambers now were empty. Shadows lengthened under the oaks. Stars came out. He walked at first slowly, and then with a cane, and then the heaviness of his flesh began to leave him, and his weakened shoulders started to ache. Some black thing was growing in a cavity behind his spine, and he felt it like a bruise when he lay down at night, and he knew it would one day kill him. In 1896, Shaw retired from the yard, haunted yet by the murders in Whitechapel, and in 1898 he was hired as Pinkerton's London agent. John Shaw, of the indomitable health, ruddy-faced, strong even at 60, who would not live to see the new century. Somewhere he heard Adam Fool had died a pauper in Genoa in 1893. Somewhere he heard Fool had been sentenced to a life of hard labour in Marseille. That last was in 1896, and he did not believe it. That was the year Japheth Flood was photographed after a knife fight in Cathay, holding his stomach in his hands. The agency grew bigger. There were invitations to speak in public, and the newspapers came to love him. It seemed a world had passed almost overnight into a kind of legend, and its survivors, few as they were, lived now like artifacts of that lost era. The years moved fast. The ocean grew smaller. He marveled at airplanes with the hunger of a younger man. But he hated the telephone, and regarded automobiles with the eye of a skittish horse, and he missed the open country. It had been 14 years since he had last heard the name Edward Shade, and that he had whispered to himself. 14 years. How did he live? He washed his hands carefully in cold water. He ate little. He stopped drinking. He lived. He was recuperating in Northern California when his San Francisco office received the telephone call. An Oregon sheriff described the holdup and the man responsible, and the style of it seemed an echo from an earlier life. A man wearing heavy spurs and the outsized and dusty rawhide of another age had walked clinking into a bank in Portland on a Monday afternoon and demanded cash. He was very old, and had drawn, with difficulty, a huge ancient revolver from under his coat, and had needed both thumbs to cock the hammer. His hand shook so bad, the teller had feared being shot in error. The man was dark and small-boned and shriveled from the sun, and he had very bright, very clear eyes. "I reckon it must be old Bill Miner," the sheriff had said into the telephone. There was a buzz and a click, and then a silence. Then he said, "If you could send someone up. We heard reports of a camp up in the hills out back of a logging outfit. It's probably him." It was the detail about the eyes that decided him. He journeyed north by special train all that night, and was standing in the empty street in Portland as the sun rose the following morning, with his nurse at his side, holding a blanket around his shoulders. By 9 o'clock they were driving into the mountains. A sunlight fell dappled through the high alpine trees, and the old detective rode with one hand clutching the edge of the door as the automobile rattled and jounced over the ruts in the road. It was a logging road, and dragged clear by rolls of timber, and they drove slowly. He was thinking of the different kinds of sunlight, and how some carry a sadness in them the way certain wines will do. There was, in that high alpine light, something that made him think of his earliest years with Margaret, when the future seemed a single, fixed thing they moved towards together. He was lonely. He was resigned. His heart, he knew, was an unswept room and would remain so until his death. There were two men with him, one a sheriff, and both were younger by 4 decades at least. His nurse slept in the back seat beside him with a red wool shawl draped around her shoulders, and her knees half parted, and her head lolling side to side as they passed under the pines. Slats of shadow, slats of sunlight. This was her world, their world, a world of telephones and automobiles and streetcars, a world of barbed wire and moving pictures. The first time he had seen a moving picture, it was of Butch Cassidy being pursued by Pinkerton men, and he had felt sick and made his slow way up through the smoke to the exit in disgust. His kind was like the horse. There was no open anywhere left for the running now. At the edge of a meadow, the sheriff parked the automobile, and he listened to the engine rattle out and fall still. The sudden quiet in the trees surrounding made him wipe at his eyes. Then the second man gestured at a thin line of smoke rising above the trees, and the sheriff nodded. There were low, tangled white flowers in the meadow like clover, and their boots made no sound as they walked. He leaned on his cane. He felt no need to keep up. The nurse he had left asleep in her seat, and he followed the men across the meadow, then up through the sparse pines, feeling the soft give of the needles underfoot. He was wearing his Colt, as he had always done, but it was holstered now, and he clutched instead, in one claw-like fist, a folder of agency documents and clippings. He wore a three-piece suit and a narrow blue tie. He moved very slow. Miner had been making coffee. When they found him, he was sprawled out on the edge of a wind-fallen log with his hands folded at his belly, and he looked to be dead, his grey face upturned and mouth aghast. After a few minutes, he awoke and wiped at a line of spittle on his chin, and peered about, blinking in confusion, then sat up and began raking through the coals with a whittled stick. A battered tin coffee pot sat balanced on three rocks. He seemed not to have noticed the three men standing at the edge of his camp. William felt a sudden great affection for the outlaw. The old crook had held up his first stagecoach in 1866. He had robbed the famous Del Norte Colorado, and crawled on his belly away from the vigilantes who were stringing his partner up by the throat. It was said he had invented the expression, hands up, and that in 1881 he had organized a small outfit of men to knock down trains in Oregon and California. He had escaped from prison that year by scaling the walls barefoot, and a trail of bloodied footprints led the guards to a flat stone in the river, and no farther. In 1901 he had slipped from two Pinkerton agents over the border to Canada, only to be picked up in 1906 by the Royal Northwest Mounted, and tried and sentenced to life. He had escaped 1 month later. He was 91 years old. The sheriff tipped his hat back with his thumb. "Morning," he said. Miner glanced up in alarm, watery eyes squinting. "Who's that?" he demanded. "Show yourselves." The sheriff held his hands out before him and stepped forward, his badge catching the light. "It's all right," he said. "Just doing some camping, are we?" Miner said nothing. "Ah, now, we're just being friendly." "You boys best be getting along," Miner said.
"You wouldn't be interested in us, Bill," the second man said. "We're not worth the robbing."
Miner glared at them.
"Who you boys with?" he demanded. "What outfit you got?" "No one's with anyone anymore, Bill," William said. He felt so tired. He said, "There are no outfits. All that's finished now. It's been over for 15 years.
Miner furrowed his brows suspiciously.
"I know you," he said.
The sheriff had set his thumbs on the revolver in his belt, but he did not look as if he had any expectation of drawing.
He said, "You know why we're here, Mr. Miner? We've come to get the $12,000 back and to bring you in for the robbery of the Northern Securities Bank in Portland."
Miner grinned. His head was trembling, and when he took off his hat he was bald as a tortoise, and his scalp looked liver-spotted and old. A ring of grime encircled his skull like war paint.
"Portland! Portland!" he said. "Isn't that in Arizona? I just come up here for the camping, Sheriff. There ain't no law against that now."
William smiled despite himself.
"You didn't rob the Northern Securities?"
"No, sir, I never did."
"You didn't escape from a jail in Vancouver 7 years back?"
"No, I did not."
"There isn't a bag of money and securities somewhere in this camp if we go looking for it."
Miner worked his gums and frowned.
"What's here is all my own property. You take any of it, and that's called robbery."
William shrugged tiredly and looked at the sheriff, then opened the folder and passed it across to Miner. Photographs, trial transcripts, testimonies from long-forgotten stagecoach robberies. Then he passed across a copy of eyewitness accounts of the recent holdup. The outlaw squinted and shook. He could see the man's ancient fingers trembling.
"Son of a bitch," Miner said. "Look at this. Look at how handsome I was." "Can you read?"
William asked. I got my letters. What's it say? Minor did not answer. He closed the dossier with care.
Can I get a copy of this?
He said. Nobody had drawn a weapon.
You know,
Minor said wearily, I'm getting too damned old for this line of work. Later, collecting up the remnants of the old man's camp, kicking through the few rags and pans, then stuffing all of it into heavy evidence satchels, brought along for the purpose. William stopped a moment and took off his hat and stared out at the trees surrounding. He said, I came all this way. He shook his head in disbelief. He said, it was just old Bill Minor after all. The sheriff was sifting through the ashes of the fire with a stick, and he lifted a scorched tin can that had twisted from the heat, then let it fall.
Who are you expecting?
He said. He said it casually, and William looked at the younger man, and his dark eyes were set deep in his weathered face, and he felt all at once his years. He was listening to the silence brush against the fir needles, and feeling the cold mountain air on his face and hands. It was a good place. In the meadow below, their strange new automobile crouched on its wheels like a great black spider. There was a nurse down there wearing a shawl the color of blood, and an ancient outlaw, and a man of the new breed, with neither face nor name. He put his hat back on his head with shaking fingers. After a moment, the sheriff asked it again.
Who did you think you'd find?
Who did I think I'd find? The sheriff met his eye. What were you looking for, Mr. Pinkerton? The trees around them were very quiet. He felt a wind on his neck.
What was I looking for?
He muttered. He was the oldest son. His eyes were failing. His hair had grayed, then thinned, and he had cut off his mustaches with a razor in cold water one winter afternoon in a hotel room in Gainesville, Georgia. His wife had been dead then half as many years as their marriage had lasted, and the pain of it had become a part of him, like a badly set bone. He would walk down to her grave on Sunday mornings, and clear the dead flowers, and fill the porcelain vase with cold, clear water, then stand reading the inscription, and thinking nothing at all. He slept. He did not sleep. He slept. He closed his eyes, and he saw. A quarter century had passed, and still he closed his eyes and saw. Darkness, like a fog, pouring over frozen cobblestones. The creak of chains sawing from hooks in alleys. Eyes in the shadows, stagnant and brown as smoke. He could smell the rot around him. A clatter of iron-shod hooves on stone. Crowds of men wending between the omnibuses in silk hats and black cloaks and whiskers. He was walking. He was walking with his powerful shoulders set low, and his fists like blocks of tackle, and it was dusk. It was night. He could just make out the silhouette, standing under the gaslight, waiting. The face was turned away, but it did not matter. He knew that one well. The battered trunk at his feet, as if preparing for a journey. That one had always been waiting. That one would always be.
We hope you've enjoyed By Gaslight, a Macmillan audiobook production from Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Text copyright 2016 by Stephen Price. Production copyright 2016 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.